From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the weekly internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Carl Franklin introducing show number 14 with guest Charlie Russell, recorded Thursday, June 28th, 2007. Run As Radio is produced each week by Quap Productions, offering professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com.
Hi there, you're listening to Run As Radio, and this is Richard Campbell, your host, and with me, my co-host, Greg Hughes.
That would be me. How you doing, Richard?
I'm real good, sir. How are you?
Not too bad. I'm going to sit here and chat with you for a little while and then run off to a wedding for the rest of the day.
Oh, what fun. That's good stuff. Actually, I'm involved in some weddings coming up in the immediate future, too. In fact, one of a famous guest we've never had on our show, but a famous guest on .NET Rocks, Kim Tripp, is getting married.
Is that right?
Yeah, so I'm going to be there for that wedding, so I'm looking forward to that. That's in a few more weeks. We're finally on the back in the saddle again after our panic run that was TechEd.
Yeah, that was a good time.
We recorded all those shows all at once. Now we're finally back to our regular routine of recording shows.
That's right.
Over the phone instead of all in person.
Yep.
And we got a bit of email along the way. Let me read you one. Actually, this email came out of a blog post that you found and commented on.
Right.
From a fellow named Robert Kane. And the email goes, greetings, Greg and Richard. I'm pleased you found and enjoyed my humble attempt at Run As Radio Evangelism over on my blog, arcanecode.com. And he references a specific post and via Shrinkster at shrinkster.com/Q0J. As a software developer, I find your show a great addition to the other PWOP shows I listen to.
Software developers listening to the IT show, huh?
And I'm almost worried. Are we doing the show wrong?
No, I think that might be an indicator that we're doing the show right.
Okay. I'm glad that software developers are interested in this material.
Crossing the software development IT chasm, as they say. Right?
It's valuable. He goes on to say something very interesting here. In a way, I've always been a bit jealous of folks like DBAs or server administrators. They have one set of technology to make work and can concentrate on their individual domain.
Okay.
I disagree.
Yeah, I disagree too, although I understand why that, forgive me for saying so, but prejudicial point of view does tend to come across. It's, you know what, in a way, it's very similar to the IT guys, the hardware wonks, if you will, right? The gadget heads that sit around and say, well, what do you mean you can't fix it? It's just software.
Right. How complicated could it be?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. So, the misunderstanding goes both ways. Although I think I understand his point. The point's well taken, but I think it's worth saying, for the record that it's never quite that simple.
Well, yeah, my experience working in IT is that you cross a vast number of technologies. You're touching everything. You're just not actually writing the code, and it's very easy to perceive that developers have it easy. All they have to know is a language.
Right. You know, the blog post that you referred to, I'm sorry, I got to say something about it that you just shrinksterized there. It was really funny. If you have a chance, go over there to arcanecode.com and check it out, or it's, again, shrinkster.com/Q0J, but it's like a 12-step meeting and talking about Podcasters Anonymous or something, but it's really pretty funny. Podcast Addicts, I guess. So, I think, and I actually commented on the blog there, but what we may have to do is come up with the 12 steps of Podcast Addicts Anonymous or something to try to work this one through. I know I've heard from a lot of people that and again, it's not just IT people, but people in development and also some people in management that I've heard from that are listening because, the conversations are interesting.
Yeah. I'm glad people see it that way. I really have a good time with it. And I always feel like we've left stuff on the table at the end of each talk. A half an hour, we just sort of tear through and you're just at the point where it's like, I want to start another conversation on this.
I love the line he used says, my wife says, I don't listen to her anymore. Or I think that's what she's saying. It's sort of hard to hear over all the podcasts. She may be saying something about the space aliens trying to eat my meatloaf or whatever, but yeah. So check out the post, and I appreciate the email and the post. I thought they were both terrific.
Yeah, let me finish out the email here, actually. He's viewpoint on developers is somewhat different. Developers, on the other hand, are like glue. We have to gather data, often from more than one database. We have to make sure our code on the HTTP server talks with the code over on the web services server. A good developer must understand how his SQL impacts the server or how his code executes on the web server environment. And I agree, a good developer needs to know that and often finds that out from the IT guy.
I agree. And you know what? The concept of, you know, the IT guys are the islands and the developers are the glue. I understand the point of view. I really think of it all as, I think of IT. All right. Here's one of my really bad analogies. You ready?
All right.
IT and developers are like two part epoxy, right? If you don't have both, nothing happens. That's really what it comes right down to.
Yeah.
And the chemical components of each of those two separate pieces are relatively complicated. And that was pretty bad.
It's not so bad. Other than the part where you can't ever get them apart again. Just to cut through there in the closing, I admit I was quite surprised in show 10 when Greg mentioned that TechEd was the first time you'd met. You work well together and sound like you've known each other for years.
Yeah, you know how you meet somebody, you know, for the first time and just feels like you've known them for a long time? I know I had that kind of feeling.
Pretty much, we just went into the next conversation, didn't we? There wasn't a whole lot of...
Yeah, it was like, hey, how you doing? Good. Hey, shake hands and good to meet you in person. And then we were just right off and just dealing with stuff and talking about all kinds of things. And I really had a good time spending time with you and Carl. Looking forward to the next time.
Yeah, we had, and the virtual tech had, the whole experience went so well. And all these shows now, at least all the shows we did in TechEd, cross-posted to the Virtual TechEd site as well.
Yeah, that's right. Is that virtualteched.com?
Yeah, that's right. And if you want to send us an email like Robert Kane did, and thanks for your email, Robert, send us an email at info@runasradio.com. All right, Greg, let's introduce our guest. It's Charlie Russell. And I got his bio here, a chemist by education, an electrician by trade, a Unix sysadmin, and Oracle DBA because he raised his hand when he should have known better, an IT director and consultant by default, and a writer by choice. Charlie is the author of more than 24 computer books on operating systems and enterprise environments. And I'm not going to list all of this. This is outrageous. There's something terribly wrong with this guy.
Charlie never sleeps.
Look at all these books. MS Press, Prentice Hall, numerous white papers, case studies on Microsoft.com, a regular columnist for the Windows Expert Zone and the Windows Vista Community site. Charlie, you've been this is what happens from living on the Sunshine Coast. You're bored.
That's it. The Sunshine Coast, where it's the wet coast this weekend.
Oh yeah, very wet coast. So he's Charlie's in my area code, but you have to take a ferry to get to him. It's a chunk of land. It's attached to the mainland, but it has no roads out of it. It's all by ferry or by seaplane.
Yep.
Sounds like a nice place to live.
It's just like being on an island without actually being on an island.
Yeah, it's all the advantages, but it is a lovely, lovely place to live.
It is indeed. Been up here for 3.5 years and just love it.
And you're ruined. So I could imagine we could go just about anywhere on Windows Server technologies, I see Terminal Server, File Systems, SBS. You've been all over the map.
I've covered most of it one way or another.
What's the hot topics these days, though? What's everybody really talking about? What are the questions that people have when it comes to Windows Server? We got Windows Server 2008 coming out.
Yeah.
You know, pretty darn soon now. We've got, 2003 R2, Service Pack 2 that came out recently.
Oh, please, not here.
Oh, it sounds like you might have a story.
I just had a lot of fun this weekend, that's all.
Let's just go there.
All right, well, let's go there.
Talk to me.
So I'm in the middle of working on my next book, which is about Server 2008, and it's for Microsoft Press, and I've got this great little HP server that HP Canada helped me get, and it's running half a dozen instances of Server 2008 in virtual machines.
Right.
And being a, you know, good little system administrator, I realized it was time to upgrade apply the latest patch. And so I put Service Pack 2 on.
So this is for the host operating system.
For the host operating system.
So you're running this under Microsoft Virtual Server?
It was on Microsoft Virtual Server.
Gotcha.
2005 R2 SP1.
Okay.
That sounds pretty reasonable. And this is a product that most people have in production. If you're doing...
Oh, yeah. It's a production level product.
Yeah. And on a production level server, too.
Absolutely.
This is what I'd be running in my shop, running sets of virtual servers.
Yeah.
Right.
Instead of just running it as direct hardware. Yeah,
all right. Well, exactly. Makes sense. You want to make sure your host OS is protected. So you're... And you said it was R2, right?
Right.
So you're applying the service pack.
And so I put on the service pack.
Right.
And I, you know, went on about what I was doing. Wasn't really paying a whole lot of attention. Had to do a reboot that night, which is when I figured I'd pick up the service pack. And that was the last I saw for 2 days of my virtual server environment.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, wow. I'm not kidding.
And this virtual server, all you can do is RDP into them.
Well, you can use the MRC, but it didn't matter because the services didn't come up.
So they weren't actually running at all?
No, the virtual server service was running.
Okay.
The virtual server website was not up. The instances that were all set to auto start didn't start.
Okay.
And the whole thing was just a very large doorstop.
Oh, boy. Now, my first instinct, Charlie, is to blame you.
Yeah, well, the first thing I thought was, there's something wrong with the hardware or there's something wrong.
Yeah, you broke it.
I did something, you know, the usual. So I thought, well, I posted a question, didn't get an answer right back. I waited at least 5 minutes.
Where'd you post the question to?
On the virtual server news group.
Okay.
And nobody got back to me in the next 5 or 10 minutes, and I was like in a panic because, of course, I had a chapter due.
Naturally.
In fact, it had been due Friday, and I was trying to get it out.
At least it was still the same month. That's something.
So I, you know, said, well, I'll just reinstall the OS, the host OS, since all the virtual machines, and that's one of the beauties of virtualization here.
Yeah, it's just files, right?
They're just files. They're sitting on the SAS RAID array.
Right, so they're not even on that machine.
They're on that machine because that's a local array.
Okay.
But the OS drives are not even on that array.
Right.
Yeah, it's the same thing that allows you to pick them up and stick them over on another virtual server and just fire them right up and go.
Exactly. If I had another virtual server with this kind of horsepower on it.
Yeah,
right.
but I get your sense. You're not devastated at this point. You're annoyed.
Yeah, I'm just annoyed.
You're just impairing your work. You're not thinking you've lost anything.
I'm not in a panic. I'm just stressed because I got to get this chapter out.
Right.
So I go in and I say, well, I'll just reinstall the OS from scratch. It's a nuisance. It'll take me 2 or 3 hours to get everything set back up again. But once I reinstall virtual server and re-add these things in, everything will be happy.
Right.
I did it. I reinstalled everything back in, ran the round of updates.
And everything was great.
Everything was great for a while.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So they started up and everything.
Oh, yeah. I thought, wow, that took care of that.
Yep.
It eventually started prompting me for SP2 again, and when it finally woke up to the WSIS server that said it wanted it, and I said, oh, okay. Applied it. Went on about my work. And I better reboot and get this thing. I had something else I needed to install, too. And so I installed that, did the reboot, and all my instances were gone.
Of course. Because when you rebuilt the operating system, you didn't apply SP2.
Of course not. So I thought, well, maybe this is SP2 after virtual server.
Yeah, that's a logical assumption. Well, maybe what I should do is start a fresh OS, apply the service pack, and then install virtual server, right?
Right.
Okay.
And I tried uninstalling the service pack. That didn't fix it.
Never does.
Never does. So we're back. This is now Saturday night, about 11 o'clock at night.
Nothing better to do, right?
yeah.
Right.
So I reinstall Windows Server 2003 R2 again, start it off and go to bed, get up in the morning, do a few more reboots, apply all the various things, add all the products in that I need added in.
And including SP2 at this point before you put this off.
And the last thing I do is SP2. Server seems happy. It's joined to the domain. You know, everything's communicating fine, I think. I install virtual server. It seems to be okay. I bring the instances up the first time everything works, and then it doesn't work again. And I finally just decided that SP2 was not going to be on this or any other machine for a while.
Right. Okay. Now I'm a little suspicious of SP2. Had anything come back at the news group at this point? Because I got to imagine you're still watching.
No, I watched the news. Nobody answered all weekend. It was a quiet weekend.
Ah.
I finally actually got an answer on Monday, a reply on Monday from the Microsoft product manager, Ben Alexander.
Yeah, so I'm curious, what so was this ever defined? Have you figured out the problem? What was the deal?
It's SP2. I think it's probably what SP2 does to network adapters.
Right.
Interesting.
This HP network adapter is one of those adapters that does TCP offload and all those other things.
Right.
And SP2 really mucks them up.
Wow.
You can't install it. You have the same problem installing SP2 on SBS, for example, small business server.
Right.
If you've got one of those network adapters, and they're basically either Broadcom or NVIDIA based, they have the problems.
Gotcha. I have heard about this.
And SP2 is just a disaster for it. And it doesn't appear that anybody's going to do anything about it anytime soon.
So basically means if you've got any of this conflicting hardware, you can't install SP2.
I would not, without making sure that you had a clear understanding from the manufacturer that they're going to provide you a driver that'll work with it.
Then how did this kill virtual server?
Virtual server has to control the networking.
Right.
One of its pieces is a piece of driver inside the network adapter.
Right, because it can actually, individual VPCs or virtual sessions can go grab their own IPs.
Right. They're basically bridging across. I don't think it quite works as a bridge. It's more like a switch, but the result's the same.
Right.
Yeah, the idea is that the virtual server services actually have the ability to control even, you know, into the driver level.
And so the
network adapters.
You know, that I'm guessing that's where the problem is. I can't positively prove it. But
that's what was interesting to me is you're talking about, your virtual server is not working. It sounds like maybe it's not actually Service Pack 2 with virtual server that's the problem, but maybe it's just Service Pack 2 with the network adapters on the host machine, period.
Probably.
Interesting.
Though in other respects, the host machine seemed fine.
Huh.
It didn't have any problem rejoining to the domain. Well, now that I think about it, I probably joined to the domain before I applied SP2.
Applied to Service Pack.
Right? Yeah, because that's one of the first things I do, because I joined it to the domain because that's where all my, you know, the domain server has all the stuff I need to install, you know, my screen capture utility, my this, my that, the PowerShell executables that I want to install. So always the two first things I put on any new machine are Hypersnap for screen captures, because that's my life is screen captures.
Right, making books.
And PowerShell, so I can get some work done.
Which is really is a scripting tool to everything in Windows. It's very...
I'd go more than a tool. It's both a shell and a scripting language.
Right.
And that's the, you know, it's the replacement for the much beloved Command/CMD. Unfortunately, it's not going to be in some versions of Server 2008, the core versions. At least that seems to be the indication. But
well, you know, one of the interesting things, I know that people who are running VMware, for example,
mm-hmm.
on Windows 2003 Service Pack 2, who apply Service Pack 2 are experiencing the same kind of problems.
Are they? That's interesting.
Yeah, as we've been sitting here, chatting, I've just sort of, you know, done the laptop thing here and just sort of done a little bit of searching around. And in fact, there's a number of comments in a bunch of online forums here about appearing to be a Windows 2003 Service Pack 2 issue, and where people have actually gone through and have sort of gone step by step and are basically finding out that, you know, once they apply Service Pack 2, they start to see that typical kind of behavior, the kind that you're talking about.
Right.
And specifically related to Broadcom network controllers and a couple of others.
Mm-hmm.
Enabling TOE on those controllers, and not using Service Pack 2 appears to fix the problem. Although I wouldn't call it a fix. I would call it more of a temporary and not a very good solution.
Yeah, it's not a satisfactory workaround. Most of us like to stay as patched up as we can in this modern world.
And I'm looking at the list of fixes in SP2, and it's vast.
It's huge.
It's touching everything, which, of course, brings up exactly that issue of you want this patch.
Of course I do, but I'm not going to install it.
One of the things that might be interesting is, you know, if for people that experience that problem, what I wonder is with the TCP offload settings for those network adapters that have that, you should be able to disable those, right?
You can, yeah. It's a little tricky with this HP NIC because this is a multifunction NIC that does all kinds of things, including iSCSI if you want it to. And there's enough different settings. I'm not sure which one to tweak. On a lot of motherboards these days have built-in Broadcom NICs, and they're fairly easy. Because there's only two places to go, but this particular HP NIC is, and I think it's Broadcom based. It's got all kinds of stuff in there that I think may be affected, and I just didn't want to mess with it. At some point, I'm probably going to have to, because I suspect I'll have the same problem once I put Server 2008 on there as the host OS, which is probably going to happen. We have to see how stable this latest build is.
Yeah, the list of networking changes alone is pages.
It's huge.
Pages and pages of changes.
Yeah, it was a pretty massive service pack.
And I know there are lots of reasons why they do these things, but changing the default setting that way is probably not the best idea. And it's something that they've done. They've turned on something in there that didn't need to be turned on.
Now, you know what? One thing I'm curious about, I don't know if you mentioned it on it, but I may have missed it. Are you running a 64-bit?
Oh, of course. The host is, all my stuff is 64-bit.
Yeah, for the host OS.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's interesting because one of the other things I'm noting here, just reading a couple of things, is that the 32-bit OS is that people are reporting that they don't seem to be seeing the problem there.
Yeah, that's probably true. But on a machine with 16 gigabytes of RAM, I'm not about to be running a 32-bit.
A 32-bit, yeah. My assumption was that you were, so yeah, that's pretty interesting.
I mean, I've been on 64-bit pretty much across the board for over 2 years.
So you said you had a whole bunch of Windows 2008 server, or I'm sorry, Windows Server 2008 virtual instances running. Talk to us about it. What have you been doing with all those virtual instances? And I know you're writing chapters for the book, and that's always a deadline-driven thing, but you must be running into some interesting things. And if you're doing an in-depth early look, I'm sure there's a lot of people that would like to know, you know, what's piquing your interest.
Probably the thing that I'm enjoying the most is a new feature in terminal services called remote applications, or remote programs. I've forgotten which they're calling it now.
Uh-huh.
It was originally called TS Rail. And it's, you know how you can fire off a window into another machine and basically open up a remote desktop onto a terminal server.
Right.
Here, instead of opening up a desktop, you open up the application directly. And that application is installable with an MSI or pushed down with group policy to client computers. And if it, for example, has to open up a window, it opens up another remote window session. So that it behaves just as if it were running locally. There's no desktop there. There's just your application running.
Oh, I see. Yeah, so instead of having that whole desktop look with it, like you're running a copy of the OS within the OS,
right.
You just have the window itself. So it's got to be message passing all of the info for how the window looks and your mouse clicks and movements and keyboard strokes into that window.
It appears to be. I mean, it acts just as if it were a local application with one exception. The one exception that is annoying is that it doesn't really handle multiple monitors well.
Ah.
But if you're running a single monitor, you'll never realize you're not running it locally.
I get a sense like we've got a new version of Citrix on our hands here.
It's more than Citrix does, I think. But I haven't spent a whole lot of time with Citrix in recent years. My experience with Citrix goes back to, you know, the NT4 days.
The old days.
Yeah, really old days. It reminds me more of what SCO was trying to do when they had, what they call it, Tarantella technology. In the, you know, there's a web interface that you can publish these things with, and it just completely virtualizes the application directly. It's really slick. And a huge boon for me, where I have to keep multiple versions of Word, for example, the one that drives me nuts. I don't really run my main stuff in Word 2007 at this point. It's got too many things that drive me nuts. And I'm pretty much a heavy power user of Word 2003.
Right.
So, but every once in a while, somebody wants me to work on something that's a 2007-based document, and they prefer me to stay there. Cause, I mean, the translation stuff is okay for 99% of the things, but there's a few things that it doesn't quite do well.
Right, especially when it comes to formatting and some of the new stuff, yeah.
Yeah, there's some of the formatting stuff's a little different. So
they want you to be in a .docx file is what they want.
Right. And I can read and write .docx files in 2003.
Right.
The Microsoft adapters for that are actually pretty good. But there are a few things that just don't translate right. So here I just dump it over on one of my Server 2008 machines that's got this on. I've got an MSI that installed a local version of it on my laptop. And then I just open it up like any other program from my laptop. It makes the connection, opens up the window. It's a little slow to come up because it's got to, you know, open up the remote desktop session. But once it comes up, it behaves completely like it's local. It's great.
So I'm thinking about how, am I really talking about virtualizing all the apps that way, that I would simply configure all these applications running on my centralized servers and then just have the GUI appearing on the workstations?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you remember, Richard, back the beginning of May, I think it was one of our first five shows, we talked to John Saville.
Right.
We talked about application virtualization and some of the new things that are available in the new version of Windows Server and some of the things that are coming out. This sounds similar. I'm not sure if it's exactly the same.
Yeah, I didn't hear that broadcast, but this is certainly new to 2008, and I think it's really cool.
I'm still wrestling with the advantage of it.
Oh, well, here's an advantage. Now my old laptop that really can't do Vista and really doesn't do very well with Office 2007.
Right, and all these new apps.
I could run it as a pure terminal session, but that's got its own awkwardness. It doesn't feel natural to people.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I'm on my own machine anymore. But I now, especially, you know, we're moving to 64-bit. We're going to be buying machines that'll handle way more than what we need to do. Throw a terminal server on there. Even a virtualized terminal server, after all, that's what I'm doing. These are virtual terminal server
solutions.
And that 64-bit machine can be sitting there with, you know, quad-core processors and tons of RAM and serve up these applications. I'm not going to have to upgrade people.
I'm also thinking that if I had a staff full of laptop users, rather than installing all that software on their laptops,
exactly,
they just use this.
Much, much easier. Also, if I want to do, I mean, there are all sorts of other applications, things like labs, and where you're setting up a virtual lab environment. Virtualization just makes a huge amount of sense there.
Yeah, I know. We've definitely experienced that where I work. We've really done a lot of adoption of Blade Center technology just for making things more compact. And on those blades, especially with some of the new, I don't remember the name, VT extensions, but the new hardware extensions, right?
Right.
Doing virtualization is, you know, in one blade box that holds 12 blades, we're able to get, you know, well over 100 very, very performant virtual servers going. And we do that for lab environment. It's a compact, fast to manage. It's reduced the cost of managing lab test environments in a huge way.
Yeah, you've got this one blade server, basically, blade rack. And all you need are monitors and keyboards and a mouse.
Yep. Or even you could even run it headless. You don't even have to do that. Right?
Well, you run it headless.
Yep.
But for your lab,
right,
all it is networking.
Yep.
Keyboard, mouse, and a flat screen.
Yeah. Aren't you going to need some kind of horsepower there at least to run the host environment, the environment to host the MSI?
You can use. Well, there's plenty of wind terms out there.
Right. But I mean, isn't it still got to be a machine enough that it's able to run Windows?
No, it doesn't have to run real Windows.
Really? So it's just literally like some kind of RDP terminal.
Right. Doesn't need Windows under there. All it needs is RDP.
Pretty interesting stuff.
Suddenly I feel like I'm in 1985 again. You know,
and I don't
I'm
know.
Kind of running shared processing, you know, shared resources
again. It isn't. You know, I resisted for if this is kind of awkward for me because I've been on both sides of this, you know, it still feels like you're running your own stuff. It's not like you're running a, you know, somebody else's mainframe session.
But aren't you being duped?
Maybe.
You know, I mean, maybe it is. Maybe part of it is 1985. But, I mean, you know how it goes. It's like music and hair and everything. I mean, geez, well, look at hair. I mean, the kids are all wearing their hair the same way all the, you know, the rock bands did in 1985, right? It's the
now,
same thing.
Here's a question. You were doing this with Word. You go to save the document. Where does it save?
It saved it to my desktop.
Your local machine.
I could. Because, of course, RDP supports networking.
Which I got to think that it actually saves it on the server first and then ships it to you.
It depends. In this case, I had it drive mapped.
Okay.
But to me, it's all, I mean, especially if you've got your profile set as with a roaming profile so that your My Documents folder is sitting on the server.
Right.
Then it becomes really transparent.
Although the odds are my roaming profile server is different from the server hosting this app.
Maybe. Maybe not.
Yeah, I guess it depends on whether you're crossing domains and what kind of boundaries you've put in place for roaming profiles.
I mean, I'm not going to run a terminal server on a domain controller, obviously. We tried that with SBS 2000. They got away from that.
Yeah. That
was a bad idea.
That would be bad. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a bad idea.
And I'm trying to get my head around how many instances could we run like that off of a given server? Is it a separate separate virtual server for each user? Can they actually share?
Well, no, they actually share.
I'm just trying to imagine something like Word, which is a very singular kind of app, and having multiple instances of that running.
And each one of those remember, each time it opens a window, including when it pops up a file dialog, for example. Each one of those is a separate RDP session.
Right. Yeah, even if they're all going to the same machine. If you've got four Word windows open, that's four RDP connections.
Yeah.
You better have your terminal services licensing up to date.
Well, they're going to have to do some terminal server licensing adjustments.
Yeah, sort of now a CAL model, right?
Yeah, they're going to have to shift things around a bit. I don't know how that's going to look, and I'm not a licensing expert, so I'm not going there. But if I'm running Word, Excel, and Outlook, that's really just still me, you know, and it should be the same as one session, even though I'm opening up God knows how many RDP sessions into it.
Yeah, and irrespective of the whole licensing thing, I think it would be very powerful. I imagine, and I know you probably do this as well, Charlie, once in a while, for example, you're in a Microsoft office with your laptop. Right, or you're in somebody else's office, and
right,
they just want you to have access to an application. They really only want you to be able to access it when you're there.
Right.
Now they never distribute it to you. They just give you the client effect.
Right.
And it only works when you're connected to their network. It never works any other time. I don't have to keep you off your machine.
Right.
You can continue to use your machine.
I'm still using my machine.
But the actual proprietary code that I'm using is still on my machine.
Precisely. I can definitely see real advantages when we deal with contractors all the time out in the real world, where we want them to have access to our stuff when they're there, but only when they're there and only what the stuff we want them to have access to. This makes a lot of sense there.
I wonder what else about, what are some other things you've run up against as you've been digging into Windows Server 2008, the beta? And doing your writing, what are some other things? And, you know, I mean, keeping in mind, you know, for the IT guy who's working in the IT shop, what are some of the things that really seem to stand out that are going to be really interesting?
I love Server Core. Server Core is great. It's a low overhead, non-GUI, everything's done from the command line. A few things are annoying to do from the command line, but there it is. Unfortunately, we don't have PowerShell on it, which is a weakness.
Yet.
And we'll get that. But we won't get it in the first release version of it.
Right. And for the IIS Server Core, we don't have the .NET framework in the first version yet.
Right. But at least we got IIS on there.
Right.
For a long time, it didn't look like we would.
Yep.
Server Core is great. I can deploy, combine Server Core with the new, the new as old is new again, read-only domain controllers.
Right.
And I've got a branch office in a box.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's It's hard to beat.
There's a lot of value to doing that, especially as, you know, the people are doing, you know, if you have to do branch office stuff and you're talking about widely distributed teams and you want to be able to be very agile in terms mm-hmm. of rolling those out and really be able to do that in real time quickly and be flexible, a lot of benefit to being able to have a small package that you can ship around and then you can get set up very quickly.
Yep. And, you know, I thought we were all done with backup domain controllers when we left NT4. But
yeah, I was thinking, oh boy, I got my BDC back. Lucky me.
But it is different, I think.
Well, it really goes into the same thing we're trying to tackle with, you know, application virtualization or with other things, you know, where you sort of have the lightweight copy. I need to have something locally in a small office out there to be able to authenticate against. It may not be the authority, right?
Yeah. And I don't want to administer it directly. I don't want anybody there to have to take care of it at all.
Right.
And you know, worst that can happen, it blows up, I ship them a new hard drive.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's nothing new on there. It's all read-only.
Or it's a nice light, you know, a nice light ISO image that I can just drop onto that thing, you know, because there's hardly anything there.
Yeah, I don't have to ship as much. Especially start using things like DFS. I can do an awful lot that way.
And of course, I mean, just the security profile being significantly reduced on every machine that if you're just distributing that core piece of functionality, you know,
yep.
on a machine, it's a world of difference from a threat.
A world of difference. And I think it's a big step forward. And, you know, it's interesting. I was talking to a senior product manager. Actually, I don't know quite what Tom is these days, but, at Microsoft, a couple months back. And he was saying, well, you know, we're not seeing a whole lot of people running core yet. I said, give it a break, Tom. Nobody's going to install core during the beta.
Yeah. Hello, IT guys. Change is good. You go first.
No, it's not so much that. It's people are going to play. It's like when nobody installs standard during beta. They stopped even distributing.
Right.
Everybody wants to play with the big thing. They want to see everything.
Right.
And as we get closer to ship, you'll see more and more people using core.
As they start looking at what am I actually going to buy.
Right. And when you buy core, you pay the same price for core as you do for enterprise.
Really?
Yeah, because it's the same. The install comes up, you can install enterprise core or enterprise. It's still an enterprise server.
Right.
Core is just, I don't want my GUI on it. I don't want the .NET framework on it.
Right. I only want to install this particular core role. I only want to do these particular things.
Right.
Wow. Is this NT3.1?
No. No, it's completely new in the sense that they haven't done this before. Strip out all the GUI. It's command line only.
Right.
It's funny. Notepad works. They had to get Notepad to work. Because none of them know how to use an editor except Notepad. I can't tell you how many developers I've seen using Notepad as an editor.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it was that or Edlin.
I used to be pretty good with Edlin. Now I use Vim.
I use Notepad several times a day.
I haven't opened up Notepad in 3 weeks.
Is that right? It's interesting. You know what would be really cool, Richard, is to do maybe we'll just do it right now. Send us your Notepad stories. I mean, talk about a never-ending topic of discussion for years and years and years. Notepad yes, Notepad yo. No, Notepad yo.
No.
But it would be interesting. It would be really interesting to hear, you know, what do people use it for and why do they use it? You know,
the other piece of code that goes on every machine the instant I install it is gvim.
Gvim?
Yeah, Vim. The VI improved.
Right.
And it's an open source version of VI that's been around for a number of years. And I couldn't live without it.
This is just your Unix-ness showing, Charlie.
What?
This is
yeah,
just
it's
your
my Unix roots.
Showing. That's what it is. We're coming up to the end of the show here. So getting back to the SP2 issue. So you're telling me right now you're not running SP2 anymore.
I'm not running SP2 on any machine here at all.
And it's purely, it comes down to a hardware issue. Do we have a sense of the resolution? Are we getting new drivers at some point? Or are they
I haven't
SP2?
Seen any indication from anyone that they're solving it.
Nobody's actually convinced there's a problem. Is that it?
Have you seen indications from anyone that they've identified it?
I think they pretty much know what it is.
Okay.
It's predominantly this business of turning on TOE which is TCP/IP offload engine. I think it's what TOE stands for.
Right.
And there's a couple of other things they turn on in terms of batch processing that also cause problems. And I'm not sure why they're doing it, but it's actually flipping the bit on the drivers to turn it on machines where it was turned off. And
wow.
I just think that's the wrong behavior.
Interesting.
I don't know that anybody's decided it's a big problem.
Well, certainly it's going to affect a limited set of people that actually apply it, that particular problem. But so, Richard, I think maybe one of the things that we can do is we can start posing those questions, and maybe next week or in a few weeks, we can see if we can come back, and if we get more information, we'll certainly share it.
Yeah, I think we could do that. I'll bet you this is resolved pretty quickly. Like, it's silly for us to think for a moment that any service pack shipped by Microsoft that breaks existing hardware is acceptable in any degree. I'm sure there is chaos inside of Microsoft about this right now. Whiteboards are being covered.
I'd like to hope so.
Yeah,
you know, I have indications that's not true.
Well, they're good at the duck thing. While they're fighting on this they're going to look pretty composed on the surface, but I'm sure there's some web feet paddling right now. You can't have a service pack. You know, you're talking a Hewlett Packard. Serious machine there.
Yeah.
There's some Fortune 50 companies running that are saying, dudes.
Well, what, certainly somebody is paying attention somewhere inside Microsoft, and there are ways to find out. So that's what we'll try to do.
That'll be fun.
All right, guys. Thanks very much. Kind of a crazy show. We just sort of dove into the problem. I enjoy just, you know, what are we doing today? Is that we're fighting out these kinds of crazy problems. We'll,
welcome to our real world, right?
Indeed.
All right, Charlie, and we'll get back to you. There's more to talk about, I'm sure. Half hour, we just sort of tasted what's possible.
Okay.
Thanks,
all right,
Charlie.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.